What if I let you in on a little secret that there was a war being waged on masculinity or on men or on that idea of being a man in the 21st century? Certainly, you would see no shortage of evidence. We have even the tired language of men or toxic masculinity, like this idea of men being toxic or whatever masculinity and the toxic idea of masculinity being prepared, presented, even portrayed as whatever that you see as good somehow being portrayed as evil. And the language of the war on masculinity is itself a hook. It catches you. It gives you a sense of urgency. It recognizes that the world is not as simple as it may seem. It is not about getting a job or going to college or earning a degree or going to war, but rather that there's something deeper, darker, much more secret to what is going on, and that the nefarious acts that are being portrayed or even developed against you are part of a plan to destroy the nuclear family. And the challenge with this language and the challenge with this rhetoric is not only itself, how effective it may be. A general might be giving a speech to his men, trying to inspire them to greatness with no shortage of intent on seeing those individual men, the privates, the squad leaders, the sergeants, the people in charge of the men working in the field to pursue that which is good because it is good, yet the language that they use ultimately leads them or leaves them short of being able to accomplish the goal. I bring this up in a podcast form because the way that we talk about things, particularly even in what might be referred to as the American political right, or even those who are concerned about the life of the mind, philosophy, philosophy of violence, and the true use of words, might have an issue with the way things are portrayed. In John Lovell's book, The Warrior Poet Way, on the inside cover, he starts with, "There is a war on masculinity, and everywhere we look, on every front we hold sacred, we can see the painful reminders of a collapsing order." And this book, so far, has been an excellent book, but it is one in a stack of books that have made similar arguments. If you follow the genealogy, there is Wild at Heart by John Eldridge, which paints the life of a man into chapters of being, you know, a hero or a king, a warrior, a sage. But he starts up with something like this. "I know, I almost want to apologize. Dear Lord, do we really need another book for men? Nope, we need something else. We need permission. Permission to be what we are, men made in God's image, permission to live from the heart and not from the list of should and ought that has left so many of us tired and bored." That is from the opening pages of Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. And you go back a little bit further and you'll find a book called or titled Point Man by Steve Farrar, who was behind the Promise Keepers movement. No, was it the Promise Keepers? No, it's not. It's very different than the Oath Keepers, by the way. And he has a line in an early segment in chapter one that says, "Today is different because the patrol leader has appointed you to be the point man. In essence, you're the leader. Everyone else will fall behind you. As you move out to encounter the enemy, you realize that survival of those seven men stepping cautiously behind you will depend upon just one thing, your ability to lead. Your judgment may determine whether they live or die. The responsibility hangs on your head like the suffocating humidity that hangs in the air." And he is painting this in the picture of somebody who was in Vietnam. And these three books, The Warrior Poet Way, Wild at Heart, and Point Man, are three examples of a genealogy of books that talk about something like the war against men, the war against masculinity, or the war against the family values. And it would be sufficient to say that the language, the rhetoric, has been effective. In fact, not only has it been effective, but in an argument, one might say that it is good. It is good that there are men who are pointing out the challenges, even the moral injuries that are being waged against you, the idea that you desire to do that which is good because it is good, and yet there are people out there who will seek out to take your desire for doing good and turn it into a self-sabotage, as if your pursuit of the good could somehow be used against you in that you desire to submit yourself to that which is the source of good, and yet because you have a conscience, that conscience can become attacked. But if we go back even 100 years, this is a book written in 1899, so 1899, 1800s, a book called Royal Manhood, written by James Isaac Vance. He has this phrase, wherein all the sweep of freaks and failures, of mawkish sentiments and senseless blathery, can there be found an object to excite deeper disgust than one of these thin, vapid, affected, driveling little doodles dressed up in men's clothes, but without a thimbleful of brains in his pate, or an ounce of manhood in his anatomy? He is worse than weak. He is a weaklet. What can he do? He can squeak with his little voice, strut with his unathletic members, and gabble deluded twaddle. These four books now listed are all of the introductions. I list all the introductions of these books. We have Royal Manhood by James Isaac Vance, written or published in 1899. Point Man by Steve Farrar, which, if I'm not mistaken, was first published in 1990. The year of my birth, don't at me. John Eldridge, Wild at Heart, which the first publishing, if I can pull this page up, was 2001. And now we have the latest iteration, which is The Warrior Poet Way by John Lovell, which, if I am not mistaken, was published in 2023. And if you think that I'm going to come out of the gate saying that these are bad books to read, that they are terrible, that they are a waste of your time, that they leave you unaccomplished, unachieving, or without any sort of spiritual material upon which to invest your heart and soul and mind, then you are frightfully mistaken. See, in the world of the intellect, in the life of the mind, we can criticize a component of a subject without throwing out everything. In fact, intellectually embodying the idea of throwing out the bathwater without even rejecting the child itself or the baby in the bathwater. And the exact point that I want to address in all of these books and all of these ideas is the idea that there is a war on masculinity. And it is not so much to say that there aren't attacks. In fact, there is no shortage of information to be drawn from social media or even just the legacy media through CNN, NBC, even Fox News, or if you watch any of those things, which most of this audience probably doesn't, but you'll recognize that the idea that there is an attack or there is a denigration or there is a disdain for these qualities in men is not the same thing as saying there is a war. And I present this to you not as a man saying I am better than these authors. In fact, they have all built into my life. They have all introduced good things to me. They have all encouraged, whether directly or indirectly, things that I desire to do good for. Rather, all of them phrase their books in war imagery. And if we look back even in the Christian heritage of these writers through Augustine and just war theory, we recognize that warfare is a complicated process, particularly that there is a generally understood time before war and after war. And while that line may be gray, while the line between going to war or being at peace may not be as clear as the history books want it to be, we still understand that if we use war imagery, we impart a moral imperative on those that we are speaking to. If we say that there is a war on masculinity, when was the conditions for jus ad bellum, justification for war, met? Or if there were none against masculinity, whether was there no justified case for a war on masculinity met, then we are then justified as men or those in pursuit of masculinity to go to war against the oppressor, the attacker, the belligerent, the language outside of Marx, much deeper than Lenin, much stronger than these foolish ideas present. Rather, if we say that there is a war against us, then what is the proper response? How do we go, how does masculinity wage a just war in response to the conflict fought against them? Even deeper, if you say that there is a war being waged on masculinity, and you as a man ascribe to the idea of masculinity, as in that there is something that is right and true and good about being a man, then what are your rules of engagement for responding to that war? And this is no simple idea, and this is why I want to first challenge the idea, challenge the narrative, challenge the urgency derived from this language, and that is, if there is a war against man, why are men so hesitant on allowing other men or even encouraging other men to go to war in the defense of their ideals? And maybe they're not. In fact, maybe all of these men, all of these authors, all of the people like you and I who are listening and talking and speaking and conversing and engaging in these ideas are looking for some man to say, here I am, send me. I will lead the charge. And who has enough wisdom to not foolishly find himself in the company of Timothy McVeigh or the foolish even... what's the right word? It wouldn't be sociopathic. That's just not precise enough. Rather, foolishly misguided characters who are going to go do the violence or do the evil, thinking that they are bearing the burdens of everybody else. This requires more exploration on my part, but it does go so far as to say that the folly of man is to say that they can bear everybody else's burdens as if they are Christ. And so moving forward, the imagery, the metaphor of there being a war against masculinity is a troubling problem. And it is a troubling problem particularly, and yes, if the audio changed, I made an adjustment, but particularly on the account of it doesn't give grounds or it doesn't provide leadership in the direction of how that war may be waged. In fact, what these books present is not so much a war, but persecution. And persecution is nothing new, especially for the Christian or for the community or for the world that we live in. In fact, gun culture and Christianity bear this in common, that they have been persecuted, in a sense, by not only their government, but culture writ large. Desiring to look out after your family and take care of your community makes you into a right-wing extremist or a gun nut or a crazy or a paranoid schizophrenic, even that, you know, most derogatory sense. Whereas being a Christian or pursuing that which is right and true and good according to that faith makes you a zealot or a Christian nationalist or an extremist in that sense. And so perhaps what is more appropriate, and it's not to denigrate these works that were written by honest men writing honestly to men, but rather to give a paradigm shift in your idea, not your ideology, but your understanding, is that there isn't so much a war against Christianity, but there is an active persecution against it. There is an active persecution primarily before Christianity against masculinity, because if you can use words like toxic masculinity without a tinge of self-reflection, then you are part of the machine dragging the drivels of society into the depths of hell. But if you can understand that toxic masculinity is so indescript, indeterminative, and undefined a term simply to say something that I don't like, and that the attempts at defining it only condemn it further, then you understand that there isn't so much a war against Christianity, because there really are not two sides in that fight, but rather that there is an active persecution of it. In fact, these men, these books, talk about in the front a war against you, but their response is the way that one would properly respond to persecution. If I am in a war, I'm going to seek out my enemy, find out his bases, determine his logistics, seek out his chain of command, and eliminate those appropriately. But if I'm in a state of persecution, then I am concerned with survival, the truth, carrying forward, being a man of character despite persecution. And even if the Empire of Rome or the Empire of America condemns me to death for the sake of my faith, then I will live out my faith to the end of my days. I will live out my faith, or I'll even live out my masculinity. But if it is a war, then I am to gather my forces and fight against it. This instead is a persecution. And that mindset, that definition of terms, that use of language is so very important in how we address these things. Because if we're going to say that there's a war against masculinity, then men are given they are given jus ad bellum, not jus in bello, jus ad bellum. They are given their casus belli for going to war against whatever it is, the culture, the community, the world. And it's not that they're given permission, it's that they have reached the conditions necessary for fighting against it. But if we're going to understand it as a persecution, which is how these books write, and to a better extent is a good way to understand them, so far as I have read them, persecution is something that you must endure. A war is something you must fight. Are you fighting or are you enduring? Which one are you? Because not all men can fight, but all of us can endure. And those who fight must also learn to endure, whereas those who endure must understand that there will be those who fight. And so in this kind of short description, this idea, this thought game, it's not even a thought game. What do you call it? A thought crime? No, it's I hate the word that I keep losing, but I have to find it again. Thought experiment. This thought experiment that we're talking about, or this scrying and determining of terms, we must understand that if you're going to talk about war, and men then take your words and go to war, it is your responsibility to seek after them and support them. But if you're going to call it a war, but only rely on the grounds of a persecution, then be careful about what you say. Don't call it a war if you're not willing to be a warrior, because building that urgency, the sense of a war, the sense of there being attack, is that urgency. And for no shortage of terms, men feel that pressure, that weight, that attack. They feel these things. We have this moral injury going on. The moral injury, the idea of a moral injury, very simply, is that you are being expected, you're being coerced to call that which is evil good and that which is good evil. Or even more specifically, you're being coerced to participate in evil but act as if it wasn't. Moral injuries come in two forms, and moral injury is a primary language regarding around PTSD, and I make the argument over and over and over again, and I will continue so long as, that Americans are being induced to a moral injury, where on the one hand, a moral injury is such that you experience some evil so egregious but are incapable to act on it. And in this case, in our country, in our world, the way that that is presented is that you see tyranny approach lockstep with its gulags and its Gestapo and its wicked language, and you see it approach, but you're expected to do nothing but say, ooh, I don't like that. In fact, maybe that's where these books do a disservice to the man, but I don't, again, want to throw them out. I want to say that there is much great goodness to be gathered from this literature. In fact, it is inspiring, it is driving, it is encouraging. But rather, The moral injury that we are inflicted on is that we see evil and are compelled by our surroundings to call it good. Does that make it good? No, but we are compelled. And then in a sense, in order to not suffer the consequences of that compulsion, we go along with it only to encounter that moral injury. Another form of moral injury is to see evil happen and have no way to stop it, yet still feel burdened with our responsibility to stop it. If I had only been better, if I had only been stronger, if I had only been faster, if I could have shot quicker, if I could have done the thing that I was supposed to do, then they wouldn't have died. And this is the second form of moral injury, where if we could have been more moral, more strong, more Christian, if we could have prayed harder, maybe then the country wouldn't have gone this way. And this form of moral injury is being inflicted upon one element of the population, perhaps as a Venn diagram on both parts, whereas the other form of moral injury, the one previously stated by me, is that you are expected or required to go along. Imagine it. Let's even take like the idea of the COVID vaccine, where you morally object to being coerced into receiving a vaccine for the well-being of your family, but you still go along with it, and you must endure that as a moral injury. In fact, I think so many people who took on the COVID vaccine against their wishes, against their moral conviction, were done so knowing that it may not have consequences as far as in the physical world, but very well has had consequences on their moral injuries. It has produced moral injuries in themselves. And another form of it would be the inability to stop it, whether it's election issues or moral issues in regards to your school or your community or your clubs or your families or your environments, and that this second moral injury is so severe because you saw what you ought to have done but realized in the process that you're incapable of doing it. And so these two things, I've been talking about moral injury. I want to go back to the idea of the war imagery as a metaphor, and I want to close it off with this. If you are reading about a war imagery, that you are a combatant in a war, do not be afraid, because if you are going to fight, then it is courage that is demanded of you. And that courage do not forgo that courage for the convenience of acceptance. But at the same time, if you are also in that condition where you see that it is persecution, then the solution to persecution is perseverance. In fact, those who have been to war recognize that it is a strength and endurance game. Of course, you can run the 5 mile, or you can do the push-ups, or you can lift the weights, but it is this game, this battle, this fight is a fight of endurance, in the sense of if there is a battle, then you must endure. And that if we can encourage one another to endure in the times of hardship, that we can lift each other up and we can carry each other forward, not because the hope that we have is in ourselves, but because it is in Christ. And if we are going to take on the persecution model, then we must only look at Soviet Russia, where Christians endured the persecution, where in Rome, the Christians endured the persecution because they endured it. They said, this is persecution, not war. We will endure. If we are going to go and call it war, go to war. And when men go to war, when they sharpen the knife and load the rifle and they go and find the enemy, do not condemn them for doing what you called them to do by your language. But if you call it persecution, recognize that it is your duty then as a leader to encourage others in the faith through hardship, through suffering, towards greatness, towards Christ, towards that which is the source of good. And if we leave it at that, if we close all this nature off, it sounds like I am ripping into these authors who have written books before me, who have done more than what I have accomplished, who are the men who come before me, then let me say this. We as men, and we as intellectuals, and we as people of the mind, and who can understand ideas, can look at a person that we admire and say, I love you, I am thankful for the encouragement that you've given me, and yet this is something that I wish was different about you, or this is something that I think needs changed. And if we are going to make those changes in one another, then we need relationship. And if we are going to engage in relationship with one another, then we cannot forego the vulnerability of accepting retort and response. And yet we must be burdened with the responsibility of wisdom to seek after that which is right and true and good and build it up on one another. So if this argument goes so far as to say, no, that there is not a war on masculinity, but rather a persecution, then I will stand with you. But if you say that there is a continued war against Christianity or against masculinity, then when men go to war in response to a jus ad bellum, justification for war, do not stand in their way. Do not go in their way and say, oh yes, I wanted you to go to war on my behalf. I wanted you to go to war on my behalf, but not like that, even though you didn't take the time to invest in them. And so we will get into more chapters on the warrior poet way. In fact, I think I need to do some reviews on famous speeches written in Atlas Shrugged. And in the time going forward, we will talk to you soon. But if you want to support the show, you can head over to redactedculture.locals.com. Or if you want to check out our merch, go to redactedllc.com. But when I say this, go forth and conquer as the conclusion, it is because we are more than conquerors, not because of our strength, but because of Christ who goes before us. So, go forth and conquer.
You now face godlike judgment. May it extend eternally.